That's only just hit me, actually. We've never really spoken about it in this much detail, so it's interesting that we're doing this. Yeah. But you used to really shy away from lifting heavy things because you thought, to some extent, that your back would go, that you were weak.
My wrist, I'd have straps. My wrist,
yeah.
Not for me today, you know, yeah. I'd love to just get your thoughts now on what happened to me. And you did brain scans. Maybe we can just, let's just pick this apart, because this is really cool.
The truth is that there are limiting beliefs that you were consciously aware of, but there would have been a whole host of other limiting beliefs you would have had no idea had they existed unless you've done a lot more self-work. So I ask a very particular part of you to begin correcting and bringing back into harmony other parts of you in the way that was the most appropriate for you. That's a really simplified way of saying it. What ended up happening from a neurological standpoint is just the way that you have an ECG looking at the electrical rhythms of the heart. There's something called an EEG or a QEEG machine that can look at the electrical rhythms of the brain. Right now, as we're having this conversation, we'd be seeing a lot of what's known as a beta wave. When we're in a daydream, you'll start to enter what's known as a bit of an alpha state. When you start to go into really deep hypnosis, you'll see lots of what's known as a theta state. And when you're asleep, that's a delta state. What we saw is when you opened your eyes at the end and had to do that experiment, and James was reading the electrical rhythms of your cat, he could see that, and he was really careful with the way that he phrased this, is that it wasn't that there was more alpha waves in your brain. You don't want to judge brain waves, but what you can see is that when people are sometimes locked in anxiety or they're locked in the past, you can see quite a lot of alpha because they have to be in some form of mild daydream to be able to access those memories. So it's not necessarily more alpha that you want to see, it's more alpha resonance. And what he said is that when people are in really present and positive states, you will see more resonance in the waves. What we saw in your brain was that went up by just over 400%. So what it meant is that afterwards, you were able to see things, you were able to make decisions, you were able to view things without the baggage of the past.
Hello, my friends, and welcome to Take a Deep Breath. My name is Mike Mayer, and this is a podcast all about health, wellness, growth, and change. And I've got a really special episode for you today. This guest literally changed my brain. So what do I mean by that? Let's break that down a little bit. So today's guest is Scott Lester Woods. He's a clinical hypnotherapist. He's an author, podcaster, YouTuber, an all-round awesome dude. And he's my best friend, and he changed my brain. So he did a process on me known as superconscious coding. And I went in there very, very skeptical. I've known Scott for about 8 years now, and it took about 7 years for me to be convinced to actually do any sort of hypnotherapy, because I thought it just won't work on me. I'm just not the sort of person that can be hypnotized. But I had a baby about a year ago and just wasn't really looking after my body properly. I wasn't really working out. And I knew I needed to make some sort of change. And so I eventually asked him for some help and became a client and worked with him. And we went through his process and everything shifted for me. Not only can you see it on the brain scans, I became absolutely obsessed with working out in a healthy way. I've never worked out as much as I've done before. I've picked up jiu-jitsu again. My body feels strong and lean. And I put it down to the work that I did with Scott. So I said, look, you've got to come back on this podcast and you've got to share with people what's going on here, because it blew my mind. Because breath work is a very important component of health, as is touching the earth and eating the right foods. But also the world that we live in, we do need modalities like hypnotherapy, like the superconscious coding, because there's so much stuff going on and actually we can get into our own brains and we do this process on ourselves. I'll let Scott explain it in the podcast. But if you're on the fence about this, I would consider having a conversation with Scott. The link is going to be down below for him. And in this podcast, we're going to share what is the superconscious coding process, how does it work, who does it work for and who doesn't? What are some of the test cases? What are some of the things that people have experienced? You know, he blows me away when I hear about some of the client transformations. And so you're going to get an absolute ton from this. And I get to share my best friend with you as well. We did this in a studio, so it's a beautiful setup. But anyway, I'm getting geeky here. So I can't wait for you to enjoy this. The only ask I have before we get started is, could you please hit the subscribe button for us? It helps us bring on more guests, it helps us grow the channel, and it helps more people get help by learning this information. Okay, here he is, Mr. Scott Lester Woods. Cheers. Hello, mate. I'm really looking forward to sitting down with you. How are you, first of all?
Yeah, very good. Very good indeed. Thank you for asking.
Good. Let's start with, just for people that have heard the term hypnotist or hypnotherapist, but don't actually know what it means. Can you just describe for us what that is?
Sure. So a little bit like you might get someone like a psychotherapist or a talking therapist or a counsellor, just use a conventional type of analytical therapy to be able to help people make a transformation, whether it's healing an element of their past or helping them move towards a future. Hypnotherapy is identical to that, except we're using the phenomenon of hypnosis. And by the phenomenon of hypnosis, I mean the ability to go into the subconscious mind and make changes at a deeper level. So to give some background, when I use those terms, subconscious mind or conscious mind, the conscious mind is what we're using right now to be able to detect, really, people say around about 7 points of awareness. So for example, you might not be thinking about what your feet feel like on the floor right now, but the moment I mention it, you realize, oh, that sensation was always there. Same with my bum on the seat, my back on the chair, or an editor in the room, or something like that. So consciously, you're only really aware of around about 7 points of attention at any given time. Subconsciously, that's everything else going on in your brain and body. So 97% of every belief and story you've ever told yourself about who you are, everything that you've told yourself about the way that the world works, the part of the brain and body that makes your heart beat 10,000 times a day, that is all the subconscious. And so hypnosis, you can see that when you're able to access the subconscious to make change, it's almost like you're changing from the bottom up as opposed to the top down. So that in a nutshell is what hypnotherapy is. So using hypnosis in a therapeutic way. But it's a very broad term for any kind of subconscious programming. So within the school of hypnotherapy, you will have lots of different types of modalities within that. So a lot of people might be familiar with the idea of regression, which is the idea of saying, hey, what if we take you into the phenomenon of hypnosis and we take you back and we get you to relive a memory? I do not do that. I want to be careful and say, not that it's not ethical, but very often when people go and they relive a horrible memory, they can have what's known as an ab reaction, which is the idea that their body starts to relive that memory again. And so at the risk of that, I don't feel like it's the most ethical way of taking someone from A to B when it's not necessary to be able to do that. There's other types of therapy like solution-focused therapy, which is the idea of when you're using hypnosis for that. You're not looking at the past at all. You're just looking at the way that you want the future to be, and you're constantly rehearsing that in your mind using hypnosis for the brain and body to start to accept that new idea and therefore take more actions to work towards it. And I do a little bit of a mixture of all the different realms and more, and I'm sure we can explain why what I do is a little bit different.
Yeah, I can't wait to get into that. Well, I'm always curious because I feel like I know you so well.
Yeah.
And you're interested in so many things and you're so knowledgeable. And I feel like there's so many areas that you could have dedicated your life to. I just think off the top of my head, anthropology is one. You know, there's so many wonderful things that you and I talk about that you're so knowledgeable. Why have you gone down this route? Why have you gone down the route of the brain in hypnotherapy? What over all of these other choices you have?
It started in a really peculiar way. I was working as kind of like a coach, a recruiter, a sales trainer for a financial services company. And I was obsessed with people like Darren Brown and, you know, Paul McKenna, seeing people make these almost like magical transformations happen, like literally in minutes. And I started learning some of those techniques. There's a particular process called NLP. And there's a particular technique in NLP called anchoring. Now, for people who don't know what anchoring is, if you've ever gone through a really bad breakup and there's a song that reminds you of someone, and then you're driving in the car, it could be 3 months, 6 months later after the breakup, and that song comes on, it doesn't matter what state you're in beforehand, suddenly you're, in an instant, you've changed your body language, you've changed the kind of tonality that you might use, you've changed the language that you might use, your entire demeanor and emotional state has changed, all through just one stimulus. So that anchor, in that case, would have been the song being played that reminded you of a partner. But you can do anchors for positive things as well. And so it's not a technique I use anymore because it's quite basic, but it's still quite powerful. And so I was taking these sales guys and I was anchoring them to be in this really sort of confident, positive state. And I remember there was this one guy where, just to show him how powerful this could be, I would take him to a much lower place than he was. So let's say a 0 to 10 of confidence. He was a 5 out of 10. I would take him down to a 3 out of 10. And then I'd show him through this anchor how he could feel like a 10 out of 10. And he stopped and said, mate, I'll be honest with you. I've had 3 counselors in 3 years and none of them have been able to do what you did for me in 15 minutes. Which, like, as an ego trip, as a guy in his early 20s, is just, oh, the power in these hands and the power of these vocal cords. How did they do it? But I realized after a while that what I'm doing is working very... All the effects were so temporary. So this guy would feel great, like 10 out of 10 for the rest of the afternoon. But the next day he would come in and he'd be the same as he was before. Mm. And so it really tickled me, the idea of, oh, people can change, but it would be really interesting to learn how to help people make those permanent transformations quickly. And hypnosis, as far as I'm aware, and you know me, I'm always exploring and trying to learn, when done correctly, for not everyone, but for a good portion of people, it's the closest thing to real magic I've ever seen. So it's the closest thing to be able to have someone one way, and they close their eyes and they open their eyes, and they're just not the same person they were.
Can you give me an example?
I can give you lots. The most extreme example, someone with PTSD, they've seen a psychotherapist pretty much straight for 12 years. They're on the call because they've said, I've been able to process things. One example of someone with PTSD, he was a soldier. I don't know the details of the things that he saw, but it was enough to ruin his life. Mm. 12 years goes by, seen a psychotherapist, closes his eyes, opens his eyes, and when he thinks about any single memory of when he was away on tour, any single aspect of his training that would have literally have caused panic attacks beforehand, he feels okay and starts to recognize that thing that was traumatic, even though he knows it's logically it wasn't a nice memory, it no longer has power over him. Mm. He's not someone who has PTSD anymore. So that's one example where it's like, oh, this is someone who had 12 years of psychotherapy and you literally got to see something change in 17 minutes. Again, is it all like that? Of course not, but it's still really cool. And so when you see that, it's quite hard not to become addicted to thinking, okay, well, if that's possible, if the brain is literally that malleable, and we know it is, people go through trauma all the time. Sometimes it only takes one person to say one thing for someone's life to completely change, even with yourself. I want to get a divorce. It's like that one thing, that trauma of, oh, I thought my life was going to look like this, and now it looks like this. What ends up changing as a result of that? Everything. And it's not always comfortable, but it is possible. And so I don't think hypnotherapy is the only tool for that, but the process that I've developed off the back of that, I also don't think is the only tool for that. But it's the closest thing I've seen to a holistic transformation, that quickly and that painlessly.
Yeah. I hear the terms subconscious, unconscious, and superconscious. Can you break those down?
I think they could all be used as subconscious. People use them interchangeably. So subconscious and unconscious can be used interchangeably. Very often they're mistaken for the same thing. The idea is that they're both happening outside of conscious awareness. And superconscious, again, that's like every word, it's a made-up term and it doesn't really mean anything. I use it in the context when I talk about like my process, the superconscious upgrade. It's the idea of the innate intelligence within you. So I always use the example of when you've got a brand new child that's in utero, and then you've got this one cell that starts to break into 2 cells, then 4 cells, then 8 cells, 16, etc., to the point where I think in the third trimester, they're replicating at 250,000 cells a second. Right? It's huge. But no one knows, why is it that this cell here knew to become part of a baby's head and this cell here knew to become part of a baby's foot? Where did that information come from? Because all those cells were identical a moment ago. And so there are some theories that there is an energy or there is consciousness or there is a soul that is sending information into those cells. Some people think that it's just information within those cells that are kind of restructuring themselves. I don't know what the answer is. At this point, I used to really care. I don't think I do anymore. I just know that there is an innate intelligence that knows how to create a fairly stable mind and body. And so when you start to communicate with that aspect of someone and you ask it to reset themselves, I'd say that the difference is that the superconscious is mainly the innate intelligence within you. So it's the source that knows what harmony is for you. That's the best description I have of it. But even that, I'm sure someone will come up with a better one.
So let's talk about me. So I've been lucky enough to be a client of yours. And we did some work together a couple of times, I think, last year. I think there was something at the start of the year, something about halfway, about halfway through. And you took me through this superconscious upgrade. So I think I came to you with some limiting beliefs. And I used the term I wanted to be my own personal trainer. And you took me through the process. I think we have it on film somewhere. I'd love to know what you did to me, because I'm the strongest I've been in the last 10 years. I'm the most active I've ever been in the gym. I relish working out now, and it's no longer a chore. And when I look back at this superconscious upgrade I did with you in around, I think it was around July, around my birthday, we went through that process and nothing seemed to happen for the first week or two. I remember thinking like, oh, I kind of feel the same, like something maybe shifted, I'm not sure. But then this kind of snowball avalanche has happened now, where actually even now, I'd like just jump in the gym with you right now and just start lifting some weights. So I'd love to just get your thoughts now, and I really feel lucky that I can get to like pick your brains on what happened to me. And you did brain scans. Maybe we can just, let's just pick this apart, because this is really cool.
Sure.
Hey, I want to just pause the podcast for a second and ask you a couple of questions. Are you looking to deepen your own breathwork practice? Are you maybe looking at ways that you can take breathwork and help other people? Are you looking just to connect with other people that are like-minded? If the answer is yes to one or more of those things, then why not come and join me on the Take a Deeper Breath community? Yes, we have finally done it. We built a home for breathwork. It's currently $68 a month. It's going to be $99 soon, so there's a 30% discount on this. Cancel anytime, not that you're going to want to. Come in and join us. We've got a really vibrant community of beautiful people. There's over 120 people in there so far. We've got breathwork instructors and yogis. We've got people just looking to learn breathing and everything in between. There's a beautiful forum where we can ask questions and share things. And each month we have a challenge. As of recording this right now, it's Breath Mechanics Month. And so we are using all of the knowledge that I've learned from all these different podcasts. And every Sunday we breathe live together. We've got a back catalogue of masterclasses from wonderful experts. We're also measuring our mechanics with tape measures and loads of other different things. And you can get started at any point because it's all recorded. So why not come and give us a try in the Take a Deeper Breath community? I'm in there. Some of my friends are in there. It's so much fun. And it's a place that I was looking for many years and couldn't find anywhere. And so I've built it myself on this platform called School. Very clean, very modern. There's no social media. There's no Facebook. There's none of those accounts. There's no ads being put at you. You're in there. These podcasts go in there early. I've got my breathing course in there, which is on sale right now on my website for $500. You get that straight away as soon as you pay $68, and there's no contract. So why not come and join me in the Take a Deep Breath community? Let's do some breath work together. We hang out once a month. There's a teacher training portal in there as well. Anyway, there's loads of stuff going on. You can do as much or as little as you want, and I would love to consider you coming into that community and having a chat with us, and let's get to know each other a bit better. Cheers.
So there's a few things. So what I'll do is just to compare it to the conventional type of therapy. You just said then something really important, which is I had limiting beliefs. The truth is that there are limiting beliefs that you are consciously aware of, but there would have been a whole host of other limiting beliefs you would have had no idea had they existed, unless you've done a lot more self-work, unless you've done counselling for several years where a counsellor may have asked you a question and then you would have realised, oh, actually, that's something that I've believed all this time and I was never aware of it. And so what I could have done is we could have gone down that route where it would have been trying to work out, okay, what are all the limiting beliefs that Mike has that is currently stopping him from feeling like he can lift heavy at the gym? I'm actually only reminded now, as you say that, how we've never spoken about this. I'm only now aware of how much you used to shy away from lifting heavy things.
Yeah.
That's only just hit me, actually. We've never really spoken about it in this much detail, so it's interesting that we're doing this. Yeah. But you used to really shy away from lifting heavy things because you thought, to some extent, that your back would go,
yeah,
that you were weak.
My wrist, I'd have straps. My wrist, yeah. Not for me today, no, yeah, yeah.
Now, we've never even spoken about that before, but that seems to have changed dramatically.
Yeah.
So what we could have done is we could have said, okay, let's look at all of Mike's limiting beliefs, all the things that held him back. And not only that, we could have also said, and where did they come from? Maybe there was this thing that happened when he was seven and one of his other brothers pushed him down. And in that moment, he thought that maybe he was... We could have gone down there and we could have spent years doing that. What also may have happened is you could be aware that those are all the reasons why you couldn't do those things. The whole point is that, one, that would have been very lengthy. Two, that could have brought up a lot of painful memories. And three, even if you knew those are the reasons, it wouldn't necessarily have changed what you were doing and how you were showing up in the gym. And even now, having that ease to say, yes, yeah, let's just jump in the gym now. Let's lift something heavy because I know I can do it. I know I'm capable. And so what I did is I took you into hypnosis. And while we were in there, I spoke to that superconscious part of you that already knew all the limiting beliefs that you had. It knew them much better than you would consciously ever know. It certainly knew them better than I did. And I asked it to begin correcting. And by correcting, I often joke, I heard it from a very famous hypnotherapist called Milton Erickson. People say, are you going to hypnotize me to do this? And very often I joke and I say, no, my job is to take you out of the trance that you were put in when you were younger. And so you weren't born with the limiting beliefs that you couldn't lift heavy. You weren't born with a limited belief, you know, you weren't born with the thinking that my wrists are weak or that my back will go or that I'll just never get that way. That was something that you had to learn at some point in your life. At what point, I don't know. Most likely in childhood, but it could have happened 3 years ago. It doesn't matter. But I asked that intelligence within you that might be something uber spiritual, it might just be one little part of the brain no one really knows, but I asked it to go and recode and not correct because it was never broken, but bring back into harmony what was actually true for you. Something that wasn't limiting you. To correct and take you out of the trance of thinking that I could never be that guy. And when that happened, I often joke, it's the most transformational experience anyone can go through, but it's also the most underwhelming. So the idea of you saying, oh yeah, I go to the gym and this is just who I am. My guess is that you don't wake up every day going, the strength within me, this is who I am, and I'll summon that. No, it's just who you are. It's just, no, I go to the gym. It's, oh, it's been a couple of days and my body's missing the gym. It's coming from a very subconscious place. So I asked a very particular part of you to begin correcting and bringing back into harmony other parts of you in the way that was the most appropriate for you. That's a really simplified way of saying it. What ended up happening from a neurological standpoint is we had a wonderful conversation with James Roy, the director of, I think it's called the BrainWorks Feedback Institute, in London. And he said something that was really interesting. And just to give people some background, again, this science is so simplified, so don't take my word for it, but just the way that you have an ECG, looking at the electrical rhythms of the heart, there's something called an EEG or a QEEG machine that can look at the electrical rhythms of the brain. Right now, as we're having this conversation, we'd be seeing a lot of what's known as a beta wave. So quite a fast electrical rhythm occurring at different parts of our brain. When we're in a daydream or a trance or we're feeling very present, you'll start to enter what's known as a bit of an alpha state. When you start to go into really deep hypnosis, you'll see lots of what's known as a theta state. And when you're asleep, that's a delta state. The monks, you'll see lots of things like gamma, but the machines that we were using to test your brain couldn't pick up gamma. I don't think that's not the way it was. Those aren't the waves it had been built to look at. What we saw is when you opened your eyes at the end and had to do that experiment, and James was reading the electrical rhythms of your cap, he could see that, and he was really careful with the way that he phrased this, is that it wasn't that there was more alpha waves in your brain. It was that, because he said, people think of alpha as this super wave. Of, hey, if you want to get into a more creative state, Mike, you need to go into the alpha wave state. That's kind of true, but it's also kind of false. And what he said is you don't want to judge brain waves. So there's not really a good and a bad alpha. But what you can see is that when people are sometimes locked in anxiety or they're locked in the past, you can see quite a lot of alpha because they have to be in some form of mild daydream to be able to access those memories. So you can get someone who's literally... they're not here, they're in their head, and they're off in a daydream thinking about the worst case scenarios. So it's not necessarily more alpha that you want to see, it's more alpha resonance. And what he said is that when people are in really present and positive states, you will see more resonance in the waves. What we saw in your brain was that went up by just over 400%. And so what it meant is that afterwards, you were able to see things, you were able to make decisions, you were able to view most aspects of your life closer to what's true. And now no one really knows what the truth is, but what we could see is that you're able to view things without the baggage of the past. When it's, could I go to the gym today? Most people, when they think about that statement, they're not just thinking if they can go to the gym today, they're running it through the filter of all the times that they struggled at the gym or found those things to be an issue, or they're running it through all the stories of old limiting beliefs. Once those things aren't there as a filter to put an idea through and you just get to see it for what it is, it just becomes more of a, yeah, why wouldn't I just do that? You're able to see it not, I want to be careful with the language here. You don't get to see it more logically, but you get to see it without the baggage of the past. And that can be incredibly powerful because most people, when they're making decisions, it's horrible. And you've always asked me this question, what would you do if you had no fear? And most people are viewing it from a place of fear. And so when we're able to remove that, when we're able to remove the negative memories that have maybe held you back from being able to see that goal closer to what it is, then the goal becomes more attainable because it's not being seen through huge weights. I hope that makes sense.
So what do you think about my transformation? What do you, what's your kind of outside perspective when you've seen this? Because it's 6 months now. It's not like I did it for a month and then stopped again. If anything, it feels like the snowball's getting bigger and I want to do more and more, and it's just feeding itself. So what's your kind of external perspective of this?
So what I would say is the one thing that I didn't like was that we only did one session on it. So what we did, everything that you were discussing about, I think it's important to put the context that I think, again, the work that we did on that was around about 15 to 20 minutes long. The actual work. There was the before scans, there was the after scans. But that's the only time in hypnosis that we've touched that. That's the only time that you've gone through the superconscious upgrade for that aspect. So just naturally, I would have wanted to have done more. I would have wanted to have known other areas that maybe were holding you back that could have taken you faster and further towards that feeling of being the personal trainer. But there is no denying that, like, when we go to the gym together now, you are a lot stronger. You have got a lot more muscle on you. When we first met, you had a lot of muscle, and then I think you ended up going veggie for a while. Ate a lot of carrots and your skin turned weirdly orange. I think we joke that you look like the kid who drank too much Sunny D.
Forgot about that.
Yeah, and you lost a load of your muscle mass.
A load of muscle, yeah.
And you've put that all back on now, and like you said, you're the strongest you've ever been.
Yeah.
But I'm sure there's other little things that you wouldn't mind tweaking. I'd also like to do some more stuff again, this is my personal preference just because I see so much potential in you, and it's always easier when you're on the outside. But there's some more things that I'd like to do around your business. For sure. But what have I seen in you? I've seen you and I are very, very, despite your very lovely, agreeable nature, you're very good at being able to tell me if something isn't what I think it is. And so I was very conscious that I didn't want you to say, no, things have changed because of what you've done. Nothing. And I always say this with my clients, we never want to play the game, please the therapist. It's no one wins from that. I don't, sometimes people think, what's the right answer to tell him? The right answer is the truth. Because the moment I know what's actually happening, then we can do something about it. And so I was very conscious and kept wanting to ask you, are you sure it's because of the work that we've done? And you seemed quite adamant that no, there was very much I went back to Poland and I started going to the gym in a way that I haven't gone before. And so that was really wonderful to see, but not to downplay it. I think we've just scratched the surface.
Oh, that's exciting. Yeah, you know, I got back to Poland and started climbing this metal fireman's pole. I've never climbed a pole in my life. And incredible. Okay, we'll come back to this on a separate time and maybe do some more work. Okay, so just talk, if you can, a little bit about what is the superconscious upgrade and why that might be, and I've touched on a little bit, but why that might be different from, say, traditional hypnosis or hypnotherapies.
So most hypnotherapy, in fact, I'll give you an analogy, because this is what first gave me the inspiration for this. Obviously, this isn't a brand new creation. This is like most wonderful things. It's just stand on top of the shoulders of giants, right? So what I'm doing is I've taken the best bits from many different practices and gone, this seems to work without needing to do X, Y, Z. So I first came across the idea of this when I heard a very early lecture from Richard Bandler, who's the founder of neurolinguistic programming. And he was talking about a chiropractor, and I've tried to look this person up and I cannot find them. Because frankly, I don't know how to pronounce their surname. So I don't know the actual, I don't know how to spell their surname. It was a chiropractor that he kept referring to as Moshe. And he said that what he would do is most chiropractors, you go on the massage chair and they literally start to put things back into place. It's your spine's out of alignment and we want to put this all back into place. And what this chiropractor would do was he wouldn't manually do that. What he'd do is he'd take someone a little bit more out of alignment and they'd stand up and they were basically walking in circles because one leg was basically shorter than the other. And they would say, bloody hell, doc, what have you done to me? And he would say, it's okay, just keep walking, because what will happen is your body will start to realign itself. So as opposed to going, I'm going to realign you, he'd take them just out of alignment so that to the brain and the body finally had feedback to say, oh, we need to correct this in the way that we know how. And slowly this person's spine would go back into alignment and they wouldn't need to go back. And so it was just a thought that I was toying with, where I thought, I wonder if the mind is the same. And I asked this to Dr. David Spiegel, who basically founded the psychiatry division at Stanford. And he wasn't sure. He said it's not impossible, more research would have to be done. But it was just that wonderful question, I wonder if the mind is the same. What if actually we're not broken and the mind knows how to be well? And as opposed to going to a therapist or a hypnotherapist to jam that person's belief back into place or to jam that story in the right position, what if the brain, the body just needs permission to move back into the harmony that it always had access to? So, and by the way, I hedged this with saying, I don't know if that's exactly what's happening. I just know the results are better than anything I've ever seen. So I'm still caveating this with saying, you know, I want to do a lot more clinical tests with a lot more people before I say this is what's happening. But it was just that question that got it started. And so what most hypnotherapy will do is they'll ask you question after question after question to try and ascertain what's the limiting belief that needs to change. What's the story that needs to change? Mm. So if we imagine sort of conscious mind and a subconscious mind like a pyramid, you've got the conscious mind, which is a tiny sliver up here, and almost like an iceberg below, you know, below what's known in hypnotherapy as the critical faculty, like the doorway to your subconscious mind. You've got all the good stuff, all the stuff where if we help change it, you're going to change. And a hypnotherapist will say, right, this person's given me this information here, so let me go into the subconscious mind and I will go change that. So it's almost like psychological chiropractors. They'll go in and they'll say, let's change that belief. Or, so that memory bothers you. Let's go back and we'll change that memory. Or, so there's this feeling of being trapped. Right, let's find out. Let's go into the subconscious and find out what that memory was. And so they're going in and basically one at a time, they'll go and change that belief. Which can be incredibly powerful.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes people won't talk about any of those things at all and they'll just do solution-focused hypnotherapy, which I alluded to earlier, which I originally trained in, but I'm not a huge fan of anymore. I just don't think it's as efficient as the other stuff that I now do. And there'll be psychological chiropractors and they'll say, right, okay, so you want to be a personal trainer, let's try and find the limiting belief that needs to change. Well, the thing that you're telling me up here is the limiting belief. So how do you know that's it? That might be it, but the chances are there's going to be 5 or 6 or maybe 300 other limiting beliefs or 500 other memories that's built on. And they'll go and treat that one at a time. And what they'll do in hypnotherapy is that there's a few different aspects. Generally, there's something like an induction. So can we induce someone into a state of hypnosis? There's known as something as a deepener, which is when you're in a light trance, what can I say, what can I do to take you to a deeper level into that theta electrical rhythm that I mentioned? So just surfing above being asleep. And then while you're down there, what can I say? Hopefully, how can I be clever enough to use the right metaphor or the right story to help change that limiting belief. So it's very hands-on. It's very, I'm going to take you here and I'm going to go and try and change that thing that you've asked me to change. Mm. And hopefully you resonate with it, or you might not. And what I did is I was working with a client. We were getting some wonderful results. And I thought, why don't I try something different? Why don't I take my hands off the wheel and guide them into that space and just start speaking to that superconscious and say, hey, can you go find, not the limiting belief, not the memory, can you safely find everything? Safely find everything that needs to be changed. Anything better than I would ever know. Anything much more aware than Mike consciously would ever know. And can you treat it in the safest, fastest, most effective way for Mike to be able to do this? And there's something called ideomotor signals that I'll send out, which means that your fingers will literally involuntarily twitch when I'm asking that superconscious questions. So you know it's coming from a very genuine place. People aren't consciously moving their fingers. It's an involuntary act. So you know it's coming from a very different space. The first person I did it with, I remember it's clear as day. I was traveling at the time. This lady had had issues where she basically had lifetime resentment of her mother. She couldn't really be in the same room with her for long enough. She knew that her mum was a good mum, but there was just so much baggage that she was still holding as a result of things that felt unresolved with her mum. And what was interesting is when I asked that superconscious to go treat it, what she ended up saying was, it's really odd, but what I suddenly saw in my head was my mum when she was a really young girl, and this huge light seemed to just come and envelop her and give her the hug that I think I knew she always needed. Now, I didn't give her the metaphor. I didn't tell her how to go treat that memory. Her mind, something, gave her the metaphor to be able to say, okay, that's what she needed to feel, see, and hear in order to suddenly realize, oh, my mum's not a bad person. I don't just know that logically. I know it in my body that she was just someone who needed love. And when she opened her eyes, she said, yeah, there's no feelings of resentment. So automatically I'm thinking, okay, this is, you know, sort of moving on your chair a bit, thinking that this is interesting, but you know me, proof's in the pudding. What would it be like when she next saw her mum? Because feeling nice in a session is great, but that's not why we're here. We want to be able to make real changes. And she saw her mum and she said, I wasn't triggered by anything that my mum said. What I realized though, was that my mum and I are just very different. And that's really okay. And so when that happened, it was like, oh, I didn't guide her into healing or healing the resentment. I didn't have to be really careful with my language to try and help her see a different point of view. I just asked that superconscious thing to do it for me, and it did. Probably a couple of months after that, there was a woman who came to see me who she'd been in 2 years of psychotherapy. She was journaling every single day. And the reason that she'd been in psychotherapy was because she had been basically sexually attacked in her own apartment. Now, again, logically, she knew all the reasons why she couldn't feel vulnerable in another relationship. She knew all the reasons why those negative thoughts kept coming back in like a cascade every single day. But knowing something logically, knowing something subconsciously, knowing why something happens is almost pointless at this rate. But what we did is we ended up doing the superconscious upgrade. And when I asked that superconscious upgrade to begin treating, what she ended up saying was really interesting and profound. She said, it was like I was in a room and there was all these filing cabinets of all these different colors. But I could see that there was this one filing cabinet that was like gray and dirty, and it's almost like no one had cleaned it. And as I kept looking at it, suddenly the color started coming back on that filing cabinet. And then suddenly, before I knew it, it was looking like all the other filing cabinets. And I knew then it was okay to open my eyes. And she opened her eyes. And again, when she thought about all those aspects, I think, I might mention this in the previous podcast, she'd told me that she couldn't masturbate without crying. And after that, I got the most wonderful and weird message I've ever received from a client ever, which was, I've been masturbating on and off for 4 hours straight, and it's been glorious. So this is someone who'd gone through that for 2 years, had memories that needed to be treated. But again, her mind gave her the metaphor I didn't need to implant or adjust that. I never, no matter how good a trained hypnotherapist I might be, I was never able to find out what would be the right metaphor that would help her move from A to B. I just asked her brain to do it. I gave the keys back to her and said, right, if you're feeling unwell, the only reason that you know what being unwell feels like is if somewhere in your psyche, in your body, you know what the alternative is. So if the only color that existed was blue, I wouldn't really know what that color was unless suddenly there was another color to be able to highlight the fact that blue in itself is its own color. And so that's the exact same thing here. On the flip side of that though, I've also had people who they've literally experienced nothing happen. No visualizations, nothing. And yet when they open their eyes, they're not the same person. People who have been smoking marijuana for years, suddenly they open their eyes and they say, yeah, I don't feel like I need it. I've smoked it every day to go to sleep for the last 3 years and now I don't really understand why I ever really needed it. But their subjective experience was, well, I felt my finger move a little bit, but it felt completely dull. I'd be curious though, seeing as we're here on camera, when you went through the experience, did you feel or witness or see anything?
Yeah, I was just thinking about that and I was like, well, did I go through a visual experience? And the only thing I can remember is seeing a really fit personal trainer in front of me, but like as like really buff, trim guy in like a cheap, not cheap, like one of those polo shirts with the collars, you know, like a, how you'd see a personal trainer dress. I remember seeing, that's the only thing I can remember from that, my inner personal trainer.
What's interesting is I didn't ask you to paint that image for me during that, because I don't do it. A lot of people, I've had clients who have something called aphantasia, meaning that neurologically they cannot visualize things. And people have been able to still go through those experiences. So you don't even need to visualize things. And the process itself isn't that visual, which a lot of hypnosis is. So I'm almost tempted to some degree to not even call it a type of hypnotherapy. It's just a form of subconscious programming. Also because I think hypnotherapy has its own stigmas and negative connotations. People sometimes think that they're going to lose control and it just can be further from the truth.
So one of the blocks I had, and I think we've spoke about this, I was very reluctant to try, because I've known you for seven years now and through your various time as a hypnotherapist and all these different things you've done as a therapist, you've spoken to me many times, like, oh, do you want to try something? I was like, I don't know. And part of it was the friendship, but a big part of it was, I don't think it's going to work on me, or I don't want it to work on me, or I can't be hypnotized. I remember I was at a restaurant once for a party when I was in the corporate world, and there was a hypnotherapist, and part of me was very scared he was going to get me dancing on the table like a chicken. So I was so like, no, I'm not even going to look at this guy, he's got magical powers. And yet there was still another part of me that thought it won't work on me. So is that like, do you have that with like many other people coming across?
All the time.
Okay. What's that look like?
So first of all, there's a few myths that you have to break, like the fact that you're not going to lose control. You're not going to be made to do something stupid. You know, I've spoken to lots of stage hypnotists now, and even then, the people who go on stage, they're not technically losing control. There has to be a level of opt-in. So the people who you see on stage are the people who said, hey, in front of a crowd, I'm yours. They're completely open. What I also do is, generally, I do, you know, initial consultations and discovery calls for people to see if hypnosis is viable for them. So there's different experiments, normally called suggestibility tests or, you know, susceptibility experiments, to actually say, you know, is this a process that would work for you? So I normally do that beforehand because I don't want to work with people who I don't get the results that I want. And then the ultimate caveat that I have personally on top of that, again, not many hypnotherapists do this, but quite honestly, I think it's because they don't feel confident enough in the results that they get. If after the first session, working with me, people don't get that, that they feel exactly the same. They say, no, it didn't work at all. I just give them their money back. So the rule that I have is I only work with people that I know I can help. That's it, period. Mm-hmm. But the idea of I'm going to lose control in some way, I can assure you, if even there was just a slight bit of chance to that, every single person at the top of the Forbes list would be some sort of hypnotherapist or hypnotist. If people could literally just, at their command, make you do things that you didn't want to do, someone would have used that to have become a very, very, very wealthy billionaire at some point. But it hasn't happened. Not once. I don't actually think there's a single hypnotherapist that has ever been on the Forbes list. And if they're just counting on hypnosis, they'd probably never get there either. So hopefully that dispels some of the myths. You have to have serious opt-in. The most important part, frankly, not just hypnotherapy, any talking therapy on the planet, is the person's willingness to change. And I'm sure you would have had that with your clients as well. There's people who you know from the get-go, this person's going to kill it. They are not going to be the same person that came into this session when they leave. And there's other people who you probably have your doubts quite early in. What I normally say is, and I took this from another hypnotherapist called Mike Mandel, who referred to a place called Threshold, meaning that someone needs to really be a 10 out of 10 on three things. They realize, one, something has to change. Two, they realize it's them. And three, it has to happen now. If someone's not at those three things, and I'll check with anyone before I ever take them on, it's if you're not a 10 out of 10 on those three things, this isn't the process for you yet. Give us some time, and when you are a 10 out of 10, let's do something. But a little bit like any change, someone needs to be at some form of threshold. Very often in any story, whether it's even a fictional film or someone in the transformation industry, or frankly, most biographies or autobiographies, you see that the biggest moments of change happen in the point where the hero or the main figure, main character, is at that place of threshold, where there's nothing for me to do except I have to change now. And so if you're at that point, I often joke and say, I'm not a therapist, I'm a smiley doorman. I open up the door and say, there you go. If you go in here, your brain can go there, but I can't walk through it for you. I'm sort of like a tubby poor man's Morpheus. It's like, you know, here's the path, but you've got to walk through it. And so there's several different barriers that someone will normally get through before we really have that conversation of, okay, can we get you to where you want to be? Mm-hmm.
You've mentioned the word harmony a few times in this conversation. Why are you using that word, and what does that really mean for people? Because I find that really interesting. What when you see bringing people back to harmony, what is that?
I know that you said it's not something that you should say, but that is a great question. That is a great question. I can't think of a better word. Balance doesn't seem to do it justice. Inherently, in your body, in your mind, I feel like there's almost like this inner spirit level that kind of lets you know when you're in balance, when you're off balance. Deep down, when you've eaten something where you're flourishing, you just know. The problem is I don't think there is a right or a wrong way that is universal for everyone. So when I say harmony, it's, is everything balanced in the way that it should be for you and you alone? I don't see it as a correcting. I don't think anyone's broken enough to be corrected. I also use harmony because it's not bliss. It's harmony. Harmony and bliss aren't the same thing. Harmony is everything's working for me just the way it needs to in this moment right now. And I can't think, maybe I will over time find a word that suits that better, but it very much is a sense of balance. I often joke, and I alluded to it earlier, that it's the most transformational and the most underwhelming experience ever. And I used an analogy the last time I was on your podcast, and you said that's the wrong analogy, and you were right. The best analogy to use for someone is if you're sitting on the runway in a plane, it feels kind of dull. When you're moving at 600 miles an hour at 30,000 feet, it kind of feels the same. That's what this process does. It's when you're in a sense of harmony, you don't feel elated, you don't feel amazing. The only time you might feel a sense of elation is if you can still, if you still have an immediate contrast to how you were before. So you've been able to feel the difference and the sense of progress immediately. But generally, if someone's in a sense of harmony, everything just feels the way that it should. Everything's just working right. I hope that answers your question as to why I think harmony is the right word. I don't say a sense of bliss. It's not the sense of right. I hate the word the true self, because I don't think there is a thing. It's just, no, my body, my mind is working at the rate most comfortable and consistent for it. Mm. It's the absence. Slight detour. I remember, maybe we'll go into my story in a bit, but I lived in a Buddhist temple for a couple of years. And I remember I was in this meditation, and it was probably the first, spiritual is a big word, but probably the first spiritual experience I'd ever had. And I must have told you this before, where I remember it being this meditation. It was around about 20 or 30 minutes in. And I remember there being this conflict in my mind where I felt like something was starting to happen. And naturally, there was another part of me that was trying to logically understand, what is this feeling that's starting to come up for me? Because it's a nice feeling. Is something about to happen? And eventually, I suddenly said, right, why don't I just let myself go? Let myself go into it. And suddenly, in that moment, I felt completely at one with everything. It's one of the few times that I've truly, really felt it. And at first, I thought I was going to have a panic attack because I'd never felt this before. But I remember the sensation of feeling like everything in the past that had ever happened, it was okay. Everything in the future that could ever happen, I'm going to die, but it's okay. Everything right now is okay. And I felt like, not that I loved everyone, but I was everyone. There was this true sense of oneness, but it wasn't elation. It was just, everything's okay. And that's enough. And so sometimes I feel like that state that people are after isn't necessarily a state of elation, because you need to have a contrast for it. It's a state of just being okay. Because I also think in that state is where there's the most power to be able to adapt to any other situation. You want to be okay in every situation. You don't necessarily want to be blissful in every situation. If you're being chased by a saber-toothed tiger, feeling really cracking and blissful isn't necessarily the state that's going to get you out of there. But being able to just adapt and be okay, that'll get you there. Hope that makes sense.
Mm. A lot of people that follow me and a lot of clients I work with, they tend to be, when I run polls, and they often say stress and anxiety tend to be the top two things, always, probably 80%. What's your experience with stress and anxiety? What results have you had with clients? If somebody's watching stress and anxiety, where could you take them? Can we ever get rid of stress and anxiety? Should we get rid of it? There's a few bits going on there, but give us your thoughts on this whole area.
Okay, so on an acute level, we need it. Again, people sometimes, there are some people who are going to heard what I'm about to say so many times they could recite it verbatim anyway. But I think it's really important to understand that stress and anxiety, they are primitive opt-out clauses. So 14,000 years ago, 10,000, you know, 100,000, possibly up to 200,000 years ago, caveman went out of the cave and there was snow or ice or danger. Naturally, logical parts of the brain will start to shut off and he might start to go into a form of hibernation. He'd go back into the cave, wouldn't interact with anyone, pull the rug over his head, metabolism would start to slow down, go into hibernation mode, and he'd wait for it to be safe to go back outside. You take that primitive opt-out clause in today's society, we call it depression. If you were walking through the jungle at any point in time, it's better off thinking that branch there might be a snake, as opposed to that snake, that thing that could be a snake, it's probably a branch. And being acutely aware and being vigilant of potential negative situations is literally what got us here as a species. So on an acute level, it's really great. The downside to that part of the brain, the limbic system, where generally most negative thoughts, stress, anxiety seems to come from, there's a few qualities that it has that a lot of people probably listening and watching this will resonate with. The first one is that it's super negative. So it is wired to see everything from the worst case scenario. When people say, oh, I'm just so negative, it's not a you problem. It's a limbic system issue. It's the health and safety officer in your brain is wired for one thing, that's to keep you alive. A little bit like, I know you used to work in British Gas, I imagine that if there was a health and safety officer at British Gas, they wouldn't have been invited to the meetings where the CEO was saying, what's our five-year vision? Because it's not the job of the health and safety officer to know that. The health and safety officer probably wasn't the most charismatic person in the building either, because their entire job is to say, okay, great vision, lovely, everyone's well-being, yeah, that's great. If a fire happens, what are we going to do? Right, that's the job of the health and safety officer. So it's wired to be negative, because it wants to care, it cares only about your survival. It's also obsessive. So again, if that saber-toothed tiger followed you home, you'd sit down and this part of the brain would say, Mike, go check the window to see if it's there. And you'd go check the window and you'd say, no, it's not there. And you'd sit down and it would say, go check again. I need you to be vigilant here. Is there any chance that it's there? And so you can see why when people, and I bet all the money in the world and my career, if anyone's watching or listening to this, if they've ever had a negative thought, they'll never just have it once. They'll have it over and over again. It's the way that the brain is wired. You're literally beating biology if you just have one negative thought once, unless you've trained at the top of a mountain somewhere. right? Where actually you don't really have much stress. FYI, that's something that people don't talk about, which maybe we can go into later. So it's negative, it's obsessive, but it's also vigilant. Meaning if for some reason or another, it thinks you could be in some kind of danger, it will literally hijack the rest of your brain and body and say, don't worry, Mike, I'm stepping in to help. Feels bloody horrible when that happens, but that's what it's doing. A little bit like the CEO isn't necessarily going to be the leader when the fire alarm goes off. The health and safety officer says, hey, come to me because I've got the protocol. I literally know better than anyone else here because that's my only job. And then the interesting one where hypnosis seems to come in with stress and anxiety is that that part of the brain, the limbic system, where a lot of this really starts to kick off, is it can't tell the difference between fiction and reality. So I think there's a Mark Twain quote, I've lived through some horrible things, some of which actually happened. Most people, especially if they're feeling stressed and anxious, it's very rarely about something that's happening now. Even, I heard this wonderful analogy, even when you're in your house and you're comfortably there and you can hear that someone's breaking in, you're not actually anxious about the fact they've broken into the house. You're anxious about what's about to happen next. It's, are they going to come upstairs? It's not they're in the house. It's they're in the house and that means what? So anxiety is very often you're simulating the worst case scenario, so negative, over and over again, obsessive. You're completely heightened for a long state. You're in a heightened state for a long period of time. You're vigilant and you're all doing it about something that hasn't happened. So you can't tell the difference between fiction and reality. Another big one where hypnosis comes in, because that in essence is a type of hypnosis. But the other one is it can't create new ways by itself of being able to adapt to new situations. So again, people talk about, oh, you know, we're creatures that want to get away from pain and we want to pursue pleasure. It's like, that's true. There is a third part though to create a triangle in that. We want pleasure, we want to get away from pain, but we also want to conserve energy. And because the brain is a very, very expensive organ when it comes to the amount of energy it uses, it'll always find the easiest, quickest, and most reliable way to be able to do something. Even if as a whole, it isn't conducive or fulfilling for you, for your entire lifestyle. So if I was stressed and anxious, I had a panic attack, I didn't go outside, that health and safety officer says, guys, I think we found something that works. How do we know? Because Mike's still alive. So what do we do the next time we have a panic attack? We're likely to do the same thing. And so now when you replay that, in an environment where we're introduced to so many stressors, day in, day out, you can see why anxiety would be something that's really easy, just generally in this day and age. Where it becomes an issue where I don't think, where people need to be, I think the best way to phrase this, when it comes to doing something about it, there's two really important things that people need to really understand. One is that anxiety isn't necessarily what's happening in your body. Anxiety is what your brain is telling you about what's going on in the body. So, for example, biochemically in the body, anxiety and excitement are really close. It's the way that your brain is literally labeling that emotion that makes the difference. Now, what can happen is someone goes to a doctor, they're diagnosed with anxiety, or someone has read about anxiety and they then say about themselves, I'm an anxious person. Suddenly you've got this umbrella of an identity. You've weaved together, sometimes consciously, sometimes subconsciously, a set of stories about who you are, what you're capable of, why you are the way that you are. And before you know it, you end up sewing the identity of the anxious person, which means that sometimes something might happen in the body, like your blood sugar suddenly starts to drop, and you've become aware that something shifted in my body. Now, all that's happened is your blood sugar is a little bit lower, but the brain is saying, what does that mean? And naturally, because I'm doing it through the label of I'm an anxious person, my brain, it becomes very easy for my brain and my body to think that might be the start of a panic attack. And then what starts to happen is the brain starts to get on a little bit of a cycle of what's the worst thing that can happen? Negative. It starts to do it obsessively. It does it vigilantly. It hasn't even happened yet, but it might happen. And that means I won't be able to go out and cut. Am I ever going to be able to get rid of this forever? And before you know it, you're starting to feel anxious again, which only then starts to create the feedback cycle of I'm an anxious person. So one of the things I do with people with that superconscious upgrade, if we're ever dealing with something like stress and anxiety, is we're never just treating the emotion. Because there are people who are, they're doing your breathwork exercises, to alleviate stress and anxiety, but they're doing it under the guise of a stressed and anxious person. So they might do a coherence breathing video. And now what you do with Vivation, which is why I'm really glad you started doing it, is you started being able to address that. Once you start to see and feel those emotions for what they are, it becomes much easier to go, hey, and it's okay. And so it's able to break the cycle. But what a lot of people do is they say, I'm stressed and anxious, but I found that breathing exercises help. So what they'll do is they'll get up in the morning, I've just always been an anxious person, and I do this thing, and now I feel great until tomorrow morning. Because I'm an anxious person, and what ends up happening, I'm sure you've had this with clients, there are plenty of people who get themselves into a really difficult scenario where when everything's been okay for a long period of time, they start to freak out because they say, I'm an anxious person and there's nothing to be anxious about. And so naturally, if you have the identity of an anxious person and you're not having anxiety, there ends up being a mismatch in the brain and the body. It's almost like I'm not acting the way that I am as a person. I'm being incoherent in some way. And so it's only a matter of time before people will then start to go back to that label of being the anxious person, living in an anxious identity. And so I want to change that identity for someone who is, as opposed to I'm an anxious person that has less anxiety, it's I'm just not an anxious person anymore. Once you're able to shift that label in the brain as to what we're identifying things as, it literally changes your life. This happened to me personally just over a year ago, as you know, when I went through a really nasty bout of jet lag. And so I hadn't had depression, anxiety for probably about 12 years. Had done the work, done other bits of coding with myself, and I realized, oh, I'm just a Homo sapien living in a time that wasn't set for Homo sapiens. That's why I was feeling the way that I felt. But if I change my sleep, my diet, my exercise, my community, breathing, the way that I'm thinking, other aspects will change as well. But I ended up having the worst jet lag I'd ever had. I hadn't slept probably for 40 hours. Oh, sorry, maybe 35. And then I ended up sleeping 4 hours. And then I was sleeping 2 hours a night for the following week. As someone who has been dubbed by friends and partners as the sleep Nazi, you know how much I value my sleep. I wasn't sleeping properly, which means that what else was being affected? Everything else. And what ended up happening was even when my sleep started to get on track, I'd started to have anxiety in my body for the first time. But I wasn't able to close the circuit because I wasn't sure that it was actually the jet lag that had caused it. So constantly my mind for the first time in 12 years was starting to just whir. And what I was realizing was I was starting to feel in my body what I'd been talking about for a while, which was the slightest change in something that I was eating, I'd be suddenly very vigilant. Or I've just had something that spiked my blood sugar, I feel really anxious. Or I've just had some bread and, oh, is that an inflammatory response? What does that mean? Wait, is that horrible feeling of the jet lag gonna come back? But the moment I did the coding on being able to change what was going on, the moment I was able to recognize, oh, it really was the jet lag, it went again. So it's just one of those, it always goes back down to the stories that you're telling yourself about who you are. That's going to dictate the quality of your life, especially with stress and anxiety.
Mm-hmm. So you did the coding on yourself. I can't remember, remind me, were you going through the process of coming up with that coding process at the time? Was there a reason you didn't do that at the very start? Was it because it just wasn't there when you first got back?
It was still happening. I was still formulating the ideas and I was only just starting to stumble upon the fact that you could really do it, like to yourself. And not only that, there is a, not to go off too much on a tangent, but I think this is really important to, and maybe I should address the identity statement in a bit more detail, is the brain will go through all kinds of extraordinary ways to protect the coherent story about who you are. So much so that it will often make up stories that really aren't based on any truth, just so your brain can finalize the loop of, oh, that's why this happened. So just to give you an example, there was an experiment that a doctor did with a patient who had short-term memory loss. So it was almost like 51st dates. They couldn't remember anything after 24 hours. And one day the doctor, you know, come in, he'd shake his hand, and they'd carry on with the session. And one day the doctor put a pin on his hand, and he went to shake the patient's hand, and the patient went, "Ah, oh, you've stabbed me basically in my hand." And the doctor said, "Oh, I'm so sorry about that. It must be something on my glove." Now, what happened is the next day, no gloves on, he went to go shake the patient's hand, and the patient suddenly said, "Oh, sorry, I'm a little bit funny with shaking hands. I'm a bit of a germaphobe." Now, consciously, that's what that patient believed. All they knew was, "Oh, when I went to go shake that person's hand, there is something emotionally in my body that's telling me not to do that. But I don't understand why that's the case." And so the rest of the brain was able to be able to create a story that seemed coherent enough to make sense, that put the guy's own concerns sort of at bay. There's another example thing, just to really bring the point home, is there's one of my favorite books, Phantoms of the Brain by the V.S. Ramachandran. He's a neuroscientist that deals with patients with different neurological disorders. And there was this one patient, it happened several times to the point where they actually had a diagnosis, but he gave the example of one patient who their left arm was entirely paralyzed. And they would refuse to acknowledge that it was paralyzed. So much so that the doctor would, you know, do experiments where they'd say, "Oh, can you just hold this tray for me with all these things on?" And the person would reach up as if both arms were to reach for it. And the doctor would let go of the tray and everything would obviously go everywhere because they could only hold it with one hand. And the patient would say, "Oh, I've been so clumsy today. I don't know what's going on." What ended up happening though is they'd say, "But you've got a paralyzed left arm." And it was almost like the fight in Monty Python where the guy chops his arm off and says, "Oh, it's only a flesh wound." Or, "All right, we'll call it a draw when, you know, he's got no limbs left." And this person would say, "No, I don't." I said, "No, but you do. Like, you can't move that arm." And the patient would, with a completely straight face, say, "But that's not my arm." And he said, "Well, whose arm is it?" "Oh, that's my brother's arm." Now, what was interesting is when they would pour ice cold water into the left ear of this patient, for around about 30 minutes, I don't know what was happening in the brain, it was almost like the tears that were protecting that person from consciously recognizing that their arm was paralyzed, it's almost like it started to disappear. And so the doctor would say, "Oh, can you hold this for me?" And while this person still had the ice cold water in their ear, the patient would say, "Oh, I can't, my left arm is a bit paralyzed." And they would say, "But you told me yesterday that it wasn't paralyzed." And they would say, "Oh, that's because I'm really ashamed. I'm really ashamed of the fact that I can't move my left arm anymore." What would happen though is after around about 30 minutes, when all the ice cold water had drift off, that excuse or that that clarity of what was going on, it disappeared again. And that person was just denying that. And they were back to, no, we didn't have a conversation. So it's almost like the brain has these hierarchies, like British Gas. The CEO doesn't need to know what the new starter answering the telephones is doing. It's not a big enough emergency to get here. So the brain seems to have this hierarchy within it to say, what do you need to know? And it will create the right story for you to be consciously satisfied, even though it's not true. You can see where I'm going, that we do this with identity all the time. Where if I'm a stressed and anxious person and I'm doing something that takes me away from that identity, something's wrong and I'll always find a way to get back to it. Which is why we need to go in and recode that hierarchy. Hopefully that answers that question.
Yeah, what do you think is going on with the ice water in the ear? Is it doing something with a certain part of the brain?
It does explain it to some degree as to what might be happening in the brain.
Wow, I'm going to try to put some ice water in my ear later and see what happens. Oh.
He did have theories as to maybe people who have things like body dysmorphia or people who have severe anorexia where they look in the mirror and they're not seeing themselves for how they really look.
Mm.
He did have a theory as to what would happen if you started to do the same thing. Would it almost lift the veil of the delusion that a part of their brain had been hiding from another part of the brain?
Mm.
So there might be something in that. But
So you have a term. As soon as you sent to me, I was like, oh, I feel like that's me. Spiritually curious.
Yes.
And now I feel like I've dabbled with that a little bit, the spiritual side. I feel like I'm very high achieving. I'm really trying to strive and grow businesses and stuff. And so I don't know. I feel like you just bottled me in essence. And you'll talk about this now. But with your clients, there seems to be a theme there, I'm guessing. So talk to me about who are your clients, and give us a flavour of some of the transformations you've had with them.
Sure. So spiritually curious. It was the best term, and ironically, I did find that term under self-hypnosis. So I said, who's the people who I can serve the best? What would be the niche that would work best for me? Went into self-hypnosis, whatever came up, and it was spiritually curious. And I thought, that makes sense. So it means that, a little bit like Chris Ryan says, follow those who seek the truth, run away from those who think they found it. Spiritually curious is exactly the best way that I would have described myself. Someone who isn't convinced about a lot of the spiritual argument. I don't smudge sage. I don't personally use crystals. I think there's certain things that are actually do more harm than good in the spiritual world. Law of attraction, I think, is a perfect example of that. And I can explore that further if you like. But at the same time, I wouldn't necessarily define myself as an atheist. The problem that we're having a lot of the time is in the spiritual circle, people are talking about scientific evidence for spiritual aspects. And it's only through a little bit of digging that you realize that the science doesn't necessarily hold up. But the people who I work with are the people who are open to the idea that, hey, there might be more. I know there's certainly more within me, and I'm open to exploring that. They don't necessarily think that they have the answers. I know as hell I certainly don't. But it's the people who say, you know what, there might be something just a little bit more, something more in my capabilities, something more in life, something more that I can be connected to. And they want to balance that sense of fulfillment at the same time while mastering that science of achievement. I say those are the kind of people who I serve the best. That's the process that I found. This process works with the best.
So give us a flavour of some of these transformations without obviously breaking any confidentiality. What sort of roles are these people doing? And I'm just curious, like what journeys have they been through with the superconscious coding?
So one that I'll give that maybe isn't that conventional, but I think it would hit with your audience quite well, is very often a lot of high achievers, a lot of high performers that I know we both work with, they're constantly trying to grow and be better. But they're doing it all on the foundation that they think to some level that they are broken. And so sometimes it's literally just recoding that aspect of them. You don't have to do this to be good enough. You don't have to do this to prove to yourself that you're capable enough. You don't need to do this to even get love, because you are love. Trying to do this to get something that you already are doesn't really make sense. But what happens, a lot of people have resistance to that because they've used that not enoughness as hunger to achieve so many amazing things in the past, that they're worried that, oh my goodness, if I lose this fuel, I'll stop achieving. On the flip side of that though, I think when people think that everything's okay, no matter what, all the time, that there's not many monks on top of mountains that have done amazing things for humanity. So I think it's about being able to balance your foot in both worlds. And what ends up happening on a lot of social media especially is the things that rise to the top in the achievement world and the spiritual world are the most extremes of either side. And what ends up happening, and I absolutely went through this myself, and I think a lot of my clients do as well, is that they feel like if they pick somewhere in the middle, that they're not doing justice to either one of those sides. That how can I make lots of money but be spiritual? Or how can I be, if I'm super fulfilled, will that mean that I'll stop doing things? And the more that we go through it, the more it's about not necessarily just achieving one or both those things, it's about having the ability to balance between those two. So very often, actually, when I'm working with clients, it's not even about saying, right, let's get you to this place. It's more about saying, let's get you to a place of such adaptability that you can balance those as well to the level that you want. It was the best term for enlightenment that I'd ever heard. It was Jamie Will from the Flow Genome Project, where he said he couldn't think of a better description for enlightenment than having the ability to bring the exact state required for the situation that you're in at will. And I really liked that because, again, meditating in the middle of a... People often say, you can meditate in the middle of a hurricane. That's probably not the best time to meditate. You know, but being able to be completely just zen and just calm the moment that you're being chased by a saber-toothed tiger, I want that adrenaline, please. Because even if I do go somewhere after we're here, I'm very much enjoying the game that I get to play while I'm here. So I want whatever flavor or whatever state is going to get me through this particular situation I'm in. So it's not necessarily about saying, how can we get you to calm down more, Mike? Or how can we get you fired up and motivated? We can do both of those things quite easily. It's about how can we get you to navigate between those depending on where you are throughout the day? How can we bring that version of you to the table as and when it's required to get the outcome that you're after without losing yourself to that? How can we get you to have the hunger to achieve those things without being lost in achieving and never being able to enjoy it? Versus how can we get you to feel okay with doing nothing while at the same time being able to flip and go back to doing something? So some of the best stories I've heard is I've got one client who literally everything personal development you can imagine, from meditation training to Tony Robbins to ayahuasca ceremonies to coaches to therapists, they were doing this all on the premise, and they didn't realize this until we had our first session, that I'm doing this because I had a bad childhood and I've been constantly trying to fix myself. And what happens is, I see this a lot, they end up saying, oh, I'm still working on myself. Or people say, you know, I'm still healing from my trauma. They don't really give much thought to, just out of curiosity, what will your life be like when you're healed? Not when there's nothing left to explore, because thankfully your growth is infinite, but what are you going to do when that trauma is healed? What are you going to do when actually you're not broken anymore? Have you got any plans for that? Because you end up being on a treadmill and you, at that point, you've got no idea when to get off. So literally, you know, despite all the things that he'd done in one session, we were able to break that not brokenness. And now he's able to literally bring that version of himself to the table with the ability to want to get better and enjoy that growth, but without the need, without the niggle, without that dark voice that's saying, you need to do this because you're a piece of shit if you don't. Again, we were able to do that in one session. On the flip side, I've worked with, it's one of my favorite stories just because it might have been a fluke, but it's a pretty bloody good coincidence. And we've replicated similar things afterwards, where he was an investment trader and these are the kind of people who I find very fascinating to work with because they never want to refer to stress as stress. It's always burnout, a little bit of pressure, but if we follow back, it's a kind of stress and it's okay to call it stress, but I don't in that setting. And he basically felt like he had depression. Again, one session. He was like, I got a message from afterwards. That's amazing what happened there, because we were able to shift that. But also during one of our sessions, he opened his eyes and said, I've got a new idea for a position. Like this new idea came to me and that's what I need to do tomorrow. And when the markets opened, he put that position and I got a message from him saying, this is the best trading day I've had in 10 years. Again, could have been a coincidence, but actually bear in mind that your brain is extraordinary at pattern recognition. There are ways to be able to boost it. Bear in mind that your brain's in its entire reason for being all the time is to try and make sense of the world around it. If you can sometimes hone into that mechanism a bit more, you can see some extraordinary things. So even though I've helped people with the trauma side and sometimes the high performers want work on that, the really fun stuff is about being able to balance between the two. And then the big one that I wish more people would do more, and I'm only really starting to come across it and develop it myself, because I'm not perfect, and anyone who says they are probably lies about other things too, is being able to let go of the judgments that you have about thoughts and feelings. So the conversation that we had earlier about that competitiveness. And what happens is thoughts and feelings will come up and people will suddenly think, oh, but what does that mean about me? And the answer is nothing. Like inherently, it doesn't mean anything. That thought and feeling came up based on a set of things that happened from when you were younger that were completely out of your control, that just happened to be in this amazing processing machine, and it just came up. So what? And so what happens is a lot of people sometimes hide their, I don't want to say hide their light because it sounds quite cheesy, but they don't embrace some of their awesomeness because they judge themselves as to what that means. And so I think if people were able to, and that's a big thing that I work on with people, one of the things that help really break things like imposter syndrome and self-doubt isn't necessarily the thoughts and the feelings, it's the judging what those thoughts and feelings must mean about who I am and whether or not I'm a good or a bad person. Whereas the moment that you stop resisting and trying to hold weight onto what that thing must mean, and you realize, oh, that person said that, and I suddenly just wanted to rip them apart. Did you? Did you rip them apart? No, okay. So what are you gonna do about it now? But that must mean I'm horrible and oh, I need to suppress that thought. And no, it came up and now it's gone. And I think being able to take life a lot less seriously, that can be very helpful. I spoke to a hypnotherapist, probably one of the biggest ones in the UK, a guy called Freddie Jacquin, and he came up with the term not giving a shit ability. I said, what's the difference between that and not caring? And he just said that so many people are not making progress or not living in balance or not living life on their own terms because they're giving too much of a shit as to what someone else has to say or someone else might think or how they might judge it. I think the moment that people stopped judging their own thoughts, their own desires, their own feelings, people would probably start to live a lot more authentically. And so that, in a nutshell, it's a broad topic. But that's a lot of what I work on with people. It's about being able to find that balance, being able to escape that judgment. And when you start to escape that judgment, you get to enjoy it a lot more. When you're playing a horror film and there's comedy music, it's not as scary. Right? When you're seeing a thought without it necessarily meaning something inherently about who you are, it doesn't hold its weight the same way. And I think if people gave that to themselves, first of all, they'd be a lot happier, but two, they'd probably start doing the things that they'd want to do, which would make them a better person and make those around them better as well.
You talk
too much.
Talk to me a bit about imposter syndrome. It's something I feel on a regular basis. When I speak to other people in my field, I think they also have this. Is it something we all have? Is it something certain people have? Can we ever get rid of it? Should we get rid of it? What's going on with imposter syndrome?
Oh, okay. So there's a few questions in that. So imposter syndrome is generally when you're starting to move away from your identity in some way. Mm-hmm. So if I think I'm an 80 grand earner and I start making 200 grand, there'll be a sense of unease about that. There'll be a host of other things that could be involved in that, like money beliefs that I was taught when I was younger. Money doesn't grow on trees. All rich people are bad, things like that. But generally, if you're starting to move into a new phase, then imposter syndrome can start to shine because it's your brain saying, something's not coherent. I'm letting you know that something isn't coherent right now. The only problem is the coherency that it's basing itself on is a very limited identity. So it's the same imposter syndrome as a smoker who stops smoking and they say, hey, I'm on day 46. And you think, oh, if you're counting the days, my friend, that's not a good sign. So it's that it's incoherence in identity. So when people are starting to say, oh, I'm earning 100,000, I want to make a million, and then there's maybe a chance of that happening, generally there can be a sense of unease or undeservingness, or I'm just a kid who came from here, I don't deserve to do this. That there all comes into identity and the incongruency between what you thought you wanted logically and subconsciously what you feel like you deserve. And so what we do is we make sure that subconscious mind can meet what you consciously want so you feel coherent. So all parts of you say, of course I deserve this. Oh, well, yeah, if I do X, Y, Z, this is going to happen. So it doesn't matter where I've come from, of course I can do that. So that's going back to identity, that's how we conquer things like imposter syndrome. When it becomes a negative, when there's times that you want imposter syndrome, is when the feedback of the outside world isn't necessarily meeting your expectations. If you think you're absolutely extraordinary and yet you have zero feedback for that, then at some point it's probably just ego. So I'd say a good way to measure that is to work out, okay, at the moment, I think I'm an X amount of, I think I'm this good a breath coach. It's like, great, get some feedback on that. So some people have the opposite of imposter syndrome. They start a business and they say, oh, I should be making so much more money because I, you know, because of who I am. And it's like, what's the world around you telling you? The flip side of a lot of imposter syndrome, and this is the one thing actually that I probably push back on Alex Hormozi about, is he says, when you have enough, when you do something competently enough, that you have enough feedback behind you, it becomes inarguable about how good you are. And he's right, but he's missing something from that equation, which is that emotional part of the brain doesn't give a fuck about what evidence is out there if internally you've got more evidence saying you're not enough, you're not capable, what about that time when you were younger? It doesn't matter how good I do this presentation. There's still going to be a part of me in the emotional part of the brain that's going to be saying, yeah, but you're still not good enough. So that's when you want to even it out. It's a really careful game of being able to say, can I get my identity to match the feedback that I'm getting from the outside world? So it's a balance. But also, just branching outside of that, doing something badly doesn't mean that you're not enough as a person. So something that's also really helpful is to be able to see things closer to what it is. I do this thing badly. Great. Does that mean that I'm not capable of doing it better? Well, no. Does it mean that I'm not good enough as a person? No. I'll tell you what it means. I can't do this thing well enough yet. That's all it means. When we add anything else on top of that, it becomes a problem. So again, it's just about stripping that back and seeing it closer for what it is, which is this thing isn't good enough yet, but I'm a human. I can learn. If I put the hours in, I'll get good enough. And none of those things should change whether or not I'm good enough. So very often, you know, the work that I do, I'll work with the core beliefs of someone as well. Core beliefs of I'm not good enough, I'm not capable, it has to be perfect, I don't belong. They're all big ones. And so when you can shift those, that's going back to what I said about the judgment earlier. It's I'm doing these things, but it's not saying anything about who I inherently am.
What's the biggest myth that people have or take away from manifesting?
So manifesting is something that I think exists, but there are many people in the spiritual community who have, they've sold the term a bit. And so I mentioned, I think earlier on in this podcast, the idea of law of attraction. Very often people, I think, have been confused with correlation and causation. And what is the fundamental principle that actually got X, Y, Z? And so just to break it down, very often the law of attraction, and we kind of spoke about this you know, in the car on the way here, because you brought to the table. You know, maybe I'm starting to believe in this manifesting aspect. And something I think would be really powerful for someone to know, just because I've gone through it. Just to give you context, there are times where I would be in the Buddhist temple every morning, I'd sit there, and I would put on particular type of music. I'd be there in literally the meditation room, and I just would feel my heart center expand, and I would be in this extraordinary state of abundance. Tears would be flowing almost every morning, like without fail, tears of gratitude. Oh, I'm so just lucky to be alive, and wow, I just feel like money is coming to me in abundance, and oh, I'm worthy of this. And I tell myself over and over again, I would feel it, I'd just feel it completely, every cell in my body. And then I'd leave the room, and I'd be reminded, you know, I'd have one of the administrators and the managers of the building say, oh, Scott, you're a little bit behind on rent this month. And then I'd say, oh, that's weird, because I thought, oh, there's abundance I've been feeling. What's going on here? So I'd keep doing that every morning. And the next month, Scott, I know you were able to just about pay your last month's rent, but you're still late. And I thought, well, what's going on here? Because I'm, what about the manifesting? My body could not be shaking with any more vibrancy right now. It's because I wasn't taking any actions. And so then you get people who say, no, you don't understand. With the law of attraction, you have to be able to do you have to get into the state of abundance, and then you have to take the actions, and then it works. And so a little bit like with the hypnosis of, wait, so you have to do all these principles? What if you took these out? Would it still work? Yeah, well then... these things weren't required to begin with. These aren't the things that are making the change. And so there are plenty of people, you and I have met them, who've made loads of money and they have not been in states of abundance. They've made loads of money and they haven't been good people. They made loads of money and they didn't think they were even like worthy of it. And even though they'd make money, they'd self-sabotage themselves and they would still have money, but they would just be a mess. You know, they didn't like themselves, they didn't respect themselves, they treated other people like shit, but they still made loads of money. So it was like, okay, if these things can be true and someone can make money by still taking the actions, but feeling horrendous the entire time, then it can't be the state that you're in that actually makes the money. And again, someone like Alex Hormozi breaks that down beautifully. Again, the other part of the equation that he doesn't mention though is, yes, you can be completely depressed and take those actions and you'll still get the body that you want. You just take the actions, you can still get the business and the lifestyle that you want. You might not enjoy it though. And so I think it's really important when people are saying, let's manifest and let's bring into abundance. It's about being able to see those principles for what they are. Being able to manifest and get yourself into an abundant state will change your internal world and will it allow you to approach situations in a more abundant way and therefore increase the likelihood of you being able to achieve X, Y, Z? Probably. But this isn't the direct cause of that, because you can still get there another way. So it's just being able to recommend that when you're working on certain threads to try and do something, working out the fundamental principles behind why something actually works. And again, I wasted a lot of time, a lot of money trying to just invite abundance into my life. And I invited a lot more abundance, finances. If I created a lot more financial wealth in times of severe stress than I had when I was, you know, crying with gratitude, etc. So again, it goes back to that understanding, what are the principles that require each, you know, making lots of money isn't going to make me happy. That's literally another skill that I have to work with by myself. So when people are saying, how do I manifest more wealth? It's being able to understand what are the exact principles that are required to be able to get the outcome that I want. Being able to be happy is a very, very different skill to making money. There's nothing personal about either of them. It's just that equals that, and that's okay. Let's not judge it. Let's just know the rules of the game that we're playing. So I'd say that's the biggest takeaway that I'd want someone to take away from manifesting. If someone says, it's weird, you know, I'm doing all this work and nothing's happening, it's like, what are the actions you're taking? So, yeah.
I think that you cried. Are you a girl?
What?
okay, if people want to connect with you or work with you, where can they go? What can they do? How can people work with you?
Sure. So if you go on Instagram, Scott Lester Woods, you'll be able to find me. There's some content there. And if you want to work with me, there's a link to be able to click there. There's a free book that people can get that I wrote. You can just go to thehighperformancetherapist.com to be able to get that. If you want to find out more about me, you can go to scottlesterwoods.com. And then, yeah, if you want to reach out to me on Instagram. It's like, that's the best way.
Perfect. My friend, pleasure as always. Thank you, my friend. Appreciate it.
No, it's been
appreciate
a blast.
The time. That was good. Thank you.
Thank you so much for sticking all the way through to the end. I really hope you enjoyed that conversation with Scott. The link is down below if you want to connect with him and learn more. And in a second, we're going to do a breathing exercise, which we always do at the end of these podcasts. But before we do, let me ask you a question. Do you know that breath work is good for you and yet you just can't seem to find the time to slot it in your day, or there's so many breathing exercises out there, it's just a bit overwhelming, and you listen to this podcast and one guest says this, another guest says that, and you're like, oh my God, there's so many techniques out there. Well, we have kicked off the Take a Deeper Breath community. The link is down below. I am so freaking proud of this community and what we've been able to achieve as a group. We've got over 100 of the world's most beautiful souls in there. We go live almost every single day to do breath work. We bring in top experts and guests. You know, I've interviewed a lot of experts. And we've become a little bit friendly and they'll come in and they'll share with us. So it's a bit like doing a live podcast where you get to be the host. We've got my course in there and it's completely risk-free. There's a 7-day money-back promise. You don't like it, you let me know, give you money back, see you later. But my goal is for you to fall in love with the community, with the breath work, with the structure, with the fun that we have. Each month we focus on a different modality, so it's like a brand new breath course each month taught by some of the world's top breathing experts. So the link is down below for the Take a Deep Breath community. Come on in, say hello, get started. I'll be waiting for you in there. You can ask me questions, we can connect, and we will be doing all sorts of fun stuff together, as giveaways and prizes and all sorts of things. Anyway, thank you so much for being here. I love you to bits. Here is one of my favorite breathing exercises just to chill us out. And after that, click on the link and maybe see me in the Take a Deep Breath community. Cheers.
Welcome to Take a Deep Breath. Today's breathing exercise is a 5-minute coherence practice with guided prompts and no music, so you can really relax and listen to my voice. Coherence breathing, or resonant frequency breathing, has many benefits, which include lowering stress, resilience to anxiety, improved heart rate variability, reducing the age of your heart, and so many other beautiful benefits. And it's such a simple practice, also known as the perfect breath. Here we'll be breathing at around 5 breaths per minute. Just do what you can. There's no right or wrong. Just use my voice as a guide and just bring relaxation to body and mind. Let's get started. Slowly, gently in through the nose and slowly, gently letting go. Softly in through the nose and softly out. Smoothly in through your nose and gently out through your nose. Softly in, softly out. Slowly, gently in through the nose and slowly, gently letting go. Softly in through the nose and softly out. Smoothly in through your nose and gently out through your nose. Softly in, softly out. Slowly, gently in through the nose and slowly, gently letting go. Softly in through the nose and softly out. Smoothly in through your nose and gently out through your nose. Softly in, softly out. Slowly, gently in through the nose and slowly, gently letting go. Softly in through the nose and softly out. Smoothly in through your nose and gently out through your nose. Softly in, softly out. Slowly, gently in through the nose and slowly, gently letting go. Softly in through the nose and softly out. Smoothly in through your nose and gently out through your nose. Softly in, softly out. Slowly, gently in through the nose and slowly, gently letting go. Softly in through the nose. And softly out. Smoothly in through your nose. And gently out through your nose. Softly in. Softly out. Slowly, gently in through the nose. And slowly, gently letting go. Softly in through the nose. And softly out. Smoothly in through your nose. And gently out through your nose. Softly in. Softly out. Slowly, gently in through the nose. And slowly, gently letting go. Softly in through the nose. And softly out. Smoothly in through your nose. And gently out through your nose. Softly in. Softly out. That's it, you're done. You're exactly where you need to be. So just be really kind with yourself now. Take a few moments to wiggle those fingers and toes as you bring yourself back into the day-to-day. If you've enjoyed this exercise, why not subscribe or share with a friend or a loved one? And if you're interested in taking your breath work to the next level, you can contact Mike Mayer directly and inquire about his one-on-one coaching packages. We'll see you soon. Breathe well, my friend.